Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. After weeks of intense lobbying on Capitol Hill, gun control advocates suffered a stinging defeat this week, in part because of opposition from Wyoming's two Republican senators. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington.
After the amendment to put in place near universal background checks failed, families from Newtown, Connecticut huddled together, hugging each other as tears streamed down their faces. Erica Lafferty's mom is Dawn Hochsprung, the principal who was gunned down protecting her students at Sandy Hook Elementary School.
Next time there's a mass shooting, it's going to be on their hands. It will be on their hands, absolutely.
Those hands Lafferty is talking about include Wyoming's two senators who helped the GOP defeat all of the amendments to tighten the nation's gun laws. From the anger in her voice, you wouldn't know that the Newtown families met with many Republicans in the wake of the massacre, including with Wyoming Senator John Barrasso.
It would break anyone's heart. The tragedy broke the hearts of the American people when we heard about it. And you want to find a solution so that our schools are safe and our families and communities are safe and things like this don't ever happen again.
While Barrasso says he grieved with the families, he also says he just couldn't agree with their pleas for action.
I met with the families of so many of the victims of this horrible tragedy, and we all agree if you could wave a magic wand so that nothing like this ever happened again, we would all do that. I don't think any of the legislation that's being proposed here actually solves the underlying problem of violence in our society. All of us want safe kids, safe families, safe schools, and I just don't think this legislation does it.
Gun control advocates aren't giving up, though. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid pulled the gun bill off the Senate floor in order to buy his party more time to gather votes. Gun control groups are now trying to flex their muscles by dumping money into congressional races nationwide. They want to show that they're a force to be reckoned with, just like the National Rifle Association. But Maryland Democratic Senator Ben Cardin says that's just not the case yet.
The NRA decided to make this a cause. And they, when they say, look, we're going to threaten to put a primary challenge against you if you support the bill, people pay attention to what they say.
Wyoming's lawmakers say it's not about the NRA. They say the proposals they voted on this week just don't make sense. Take the bipartisan amendment to require near-universal background checks for gun purchases. Wyoming Senator Mike Enzi says requiring background checks at gun shows can keep law-abiding citizens from getting firearms.
So there are difficulties with the gun check. They are not immediate. There isn't a computer that immediately says you're not this person isn't in there, so go ahead and sell the gun. And it can be a five-day process, which for a three-day gun show can be a bit of a problem, or even a shorter one than that.
Most Democrats disagree. Virginia Senator Tim Kaine was governor when a gunman killed 32 students and wounded 17 others at Virginia Tech, the deadliest school shooting in the nation's history. Kaine ushered through reforms in the state that closed legal loopholes that allowed the shooter to buy handguns even though he was mentally ill.
The better the background check system, the safer you are. I mean, we just learned that. It's an unequivocal and simple proposition, and we have an opportunity to fix the background check system with respect to gun shows and online sales to enforce existing laws, and we should do it.
But Wyoming's lawmakers say new gun laws aren't the answer. Here's a solution Enzi offered on the Senate floor.
One of the things we need are parents to be more careful and more repetitive at telling their kids that it is not right to kill people. It's not even right to bully them. And it's definitely not right for them to kill themselves.
And Enzi says loopholes aren't the problem.
The Senate should focus on making sure current laws are enforced. They're not.
Enzi didn't offer any amendment to increase the enforcement of current gun laws, though. Instead, he and Barrasso voted to block the Senate from even debating gun control and the Second Amendment. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Wyoming has one of the highest rates of suicide in the country, nearly twice the national average. Until recently, efforts at preventing suicide were left up to individual counties. But now, the state is trying a new tactic, which they hope will save more lives. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden reports.
Danielle was 14 when she tried to kill herself. Her real name isn't Danielle, but she wanted to remain anonymous for this story. As a teen, she felt extremely isolated. Her parents and siblings rarely spent time together, and when they did, they often fought. Her relationship with her mother was especially difficult.
She would ask me, "Are you okay today?" But her response when I'd say, "No, I had a bad day," wasn't to be sympathetic and listen, even if she didn't want to. It was always of aggravation and frustration, almost like, "I know that you're having a hard time, but so am I."
Things came to a head one day when Danielle's mother refused to let her visit her boyfriend.
And I got so mad that the only thing I could think to do is go in my room and try to down a bottle of Tylenol.
Danielle ended up being fine, but she says her suicide attempt was very hard on the family, and she says it probably could have been averted.
One of the best things that people can do is just be educated on the signs of people who are likely to hurt themselves, because I was definitely exhibiting them, as were many of my friends, and nobody stopped any of them. Nobody even mentioned anything.
Educating people about warning signs is a cornerstone of Wyoming's new effort at suicide prevention. What they're trying to do is institute a uniform prevention effort across the whole state. To implement that, the health department has hired regional suicide prevention coordinators who will work with mental health professionals and others in each community on suicide prevention. The initiative is being headed up by Teresa Humphreys Wadsworth, who's the state suicide prevention coordinator. She says in the past, they treated suicide as a series of isolated events. Now, they're treating it as a statewide public health problem.
Suicide is the second leading cause of death for our young people. If we suddenly had a flu that was the second leading cause of death, people would be up in their arms and doing everything they could to prevent that flu. Well, suicide is preventable.
Humphreys Wadsworth and her colleagues are conducting training sessions across the state for teachers, school administrators, and everyday citizens. They're explaining how to recognize warning signs and what to do if you see them. They're even testing out an online training program for healthcare providers.
When someone doesn't walk in the door and say, "I'm suicidal, doc, I need help," honestly, they don't come in with that message. They come in with, "I can't sleep," or "I'm in terrible pain," or I've lost all my energy.
Most agree that Wyoming's high suicide rate is partly a result of cultural norms. Keith Hodel heads the suicide prevention effort at the Wyoming Department of Health. He says many Wyomingites, especially men, don't seek help if they're in distress because they've been raised with the idea that they should cowboy up and handle their problems themselves.
The flip side of that is so much of our state is rural and people know each other. And so if you live in Lusk, Wyoming, and your pickup truck is parked in front of the mental health center, folks are going to know.
Hodel says they hope to chip away at the stigma of asking for help. They especially want to reach out to middle-aged men who have the highest suicide rate. One TV ad they're running in Park County shows a man standing in a gas station convenience store.
Surrounded by strangers. I've never felt so isolated. So alone.
Can anyone hear me? Anyone?
The ad ends with a number for a 24/7 depression hotline. Hodel says in addition to trying to get people help, they also want to keep suicidal individuals away from weapons. Two-thirds of suicides in Wyoming are by firearm, and Hodel says friends, family members, and even firearm retailers need to watch out for signs that someone might be in crisis and then take away their gun until they're in a better mindset.
It's like, friends don't let friends drive drunk. You know, don't give somebody the keys to a highly lethal vehicle traveling at God only knows what speed. And so it's kind of the same thing.
So will Wyoming's approach actually result in fewer suicides? Bob Gebbia with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention says the state's strategy sounds like a good one, but it's hard to know for sure.
There isn't a lot of study of this, and therefore we don't have as many, you know, evidence-based interventions and strategies. I wish we did.
Gebbia adds that getting people to accept help is only part of the equation. Help also has to be available, and Wyoming, like many rural areas, has too few mental health professionals. But the state suicide prevention team says they have a plan for that, too. They hope to train rural medical providers to offer mental health care, which would make mental health expertise available in more remote areas of the state. And they're optimistic that within a few years, there will be a noticeable decline in suicides. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
When we come back, we'll hear more about suicide from a mother whose two sons took their own lives. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. We're joined now by BJ Ayers. Not one, but two of her sons killed themselves, and since then, she's dedicated her life to trying to prevent suicide. She started the Grace for Two Brothers Foundation and is now the Suicide Prevention Coordinator for Southeast Wyoming. Her son, Brett, was 19 when he died in 2005. Ayers spoke with Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden.
We knew that he was depressed. He was having some trouble trying to decide, I think, you know, what he wanted to do with his life. He really didn't want to go to college right away. He thought about joining the military. I think there was some real social isolation going on with him. Not that we realized that at the time, but he started distancing himself from his friends. You know, he was having some issues with some alcohol abuse, substance abuse. He had had some contact with, you know, law enforcement. He had gotten in trouble. That would have been before he graduated, but he just wasn't himself. We tried getting him some help, actually did an emergency intervention, but unfortunately he was over the age of 18. So with all the HIPAA laws in place, we weren't really able to help him very much at that point in time. Even just prior to his death, we were in the emergency room just a couple of weeks before he died, and he did not display the parameters, I guess, that the ER docs have to look for in someone who needs, you know, some mental health help. And unfortunately, 9 days later, he died. So that was, I think, the darkest day a parent could ever imagine. So.
Except that then you had to go through it again.
Yes, it was not quite 4 years after Brett died, and our oldest son, Beau, he was struggling very deeply with, I think, the guilt that he felt. When Brett died, I think, being that oldest brother, he never really got over that. You know, I think he wanted to protect him, look out for him, and I think he really felt that he had failed. So, Beau did struggle with depression, and he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and he was taking medications. But we don't know prior to his death if he had stopped taking those medications. We're just not, you know, real sure. We tried to help him, again, the best that we knew how. We wanted him to get some counseling, and it was just like a big tornado. In the last few months of his life, it just kept sucking him down with all the bad things that were going on in his life, and he just could not seem to get a handhold or a foothold. You know, he had some relationship issues, and he was also struggling with alcohol abuse. He had gotten a DUI about a year and a half before he died, and then 3 weeks prior to his death, he was really struggling and got another DUI, so he was really faced with the fact that he was probably going to do some time in jail. He was probably going to lose his job because he couldn't drive. So he was really feeling that hopelessness, I think, and that helplessness that we talk about someone who might be thinking about suicide. We were so very worried for him and about him, and I can remember, you know, talking to him one day, and he said, "Mom, I promise I won't do, you know, what Brett did." And I think, to the best of his ability, he did believe that. He didn't, you know, I don't think he wanted to die. I think he just got to a point where that pain was just so unbearable that he just couldn't go on.
I can't imagine how hard this must have been for the family.
It was. You know, it's not something you ever get over. You know, I've actually had people ask me that, you know, well, how did you get over that? And you don't. You know, it ripped our family apart. I mean, it was just such a gaping hole that was left by both of them. And that's not something, you know, you ever get over.
Now, you've been, since your sons died, you've started a foundation for suicide prevention. You're now also one of the state's regional suicide prevention coordinators. So I wanted to talk a little bit about what warning signs people can look for. What are some of the things that you might look for in friends or family that would be a red flag that might say, hey, this person really needs some help?
And that's a good question because, you know, there are times in all of our lives when we go through a period of time where maybe we're not 100%, you know, or we're feeling sad, or we're going through a difficult time. But I think the key indicators for someone to really, you know, maybe that raises a red flag with someone you're concerned about is, you know, if they tend to be withdrawn for longer than, you know, 2 weeks at a time, if they seem depressed and down and more than sad, if they are not engaging in regular activities like you would normally see them do, all of a sudden they're not going to softball practice or they're not going bowling or they're not engaging in those activities that for them would seem normal. Withdrawing, you know, socially or isolating themselves. There could be a number of, a lot of situational clues as far as maybe that loss of a job, loss of any kind, whether it's a relationship, loss of a spouse due to death or divorce, you know, even a loss of a pet. So I think you have to look at the person that you know and say, now, you know, what's really going on? Chances are if you're concerned enough about them to think that they may be thinking about suicide or that you're very concerned about them, chances are maybe they have too.
So how should, you know, if you're concerned about somebody, what do you do then?
You know, I think it is difficult. It's difficult to talk about suicide. But I think we have to all realize that, you know, when we care about someone, it's important to have the courage, I guess, if you will, to ask them and simply, you know, state it as directly as you can. Willow, I'm very concerned about you. I've noticed this and this and this, and I really am concerned, and I'd like to know if you've had thoughts of suicide or, you know, have you had thoughts of killing yourself or hurting yourself? And I think the more direct you can be, I really think the better it is, because if you are ambiguous in any way, or, you know, if you ask the question, well, you're not going to do something crazy, are you? Or you're not going to do something stupid, are you? Well, they're going to tell you no, because to them, it's not.
And then what? What should you do in order to get that person some help, especially if maybe they are hesitant to want help?
You know, a lot of times it may be that you have to be a little bit persistent, but because you do care about that person, you want to make sure that they get the help that they need. You know, if you can stay with them and say, look, let's get someone here that can help us talk about what's going on. So maybe that's just another family friend. Maybe that's, you know, the pastor at your church or someone that you're very, very close to that you feel like you'd, you know, like to bring in and have them talk to the person also. There are a lot of licensed professionals, therapists, that can help someone through those difficult times in their lives. So, you know, if all else fails, we have a national suicide crisis line that you can actually call, and it will route you to somewhere here in Wyoming, and they can then get you to some help that's close to where you're at.
B.J. Ayers heads up the Grace for Two Brothers Foundation and is also one of the state's regional suicide prevention coordinators. Thank you so much for talking with us, B.J.
You bet. Thank you for having me.
The Wyoming Oil and Gas Conservation Commission recently okayed an aquifer exemption that would permit Encana Oil and Gas to pump wastewater from their oil and gas projects in the Moneta Divide into the Madison Aquifer, about 60 miles outside of Casper. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhuroff reports that the exemption isn't exactly a rarity, but it does bring up some big questions.
Encana says it needs to dispose of produced water into the Madison Aquifer in order to grow its operations in the Moneta Divide oil and gas field. Encana first proposed the injection well in 2011. The Wyoming Oil and Gas Conservation Commission gave the project the go-ahead then. as long as Encana could show that the water quality in the Madison at the pump site contained more than 5,000 milligrams per liter of total dissolved solids, or TDS. In other words, they okayed it, contingent on the water being of pretty poor quality. But Encana came back after sampling and said the water is actually of pretty good quality. That surprised everyone, including Encana. So Encana's lawyer, Walter Eggers, says instead of basing their request on water quality, they're basing their request on the fact that it's too hard to get to for public consumption. Speaking at the commission's public hearing in March, he explained that there are different criteria for granting an exemption. He admits that this one is rare.
If the aquifer is situated at a depth or location which makes recovery of fresh and potable water economically or technologically impractical.
The proposed injection well is 15,000 feet deep. Water wells are usually much shallower than that. It's expensive to drill that deep, and Encana's Paul Ulrich says no one ever will.
We took a look at many other potential sources of water that could be used at much shallower depths, and our analysis demonstrated to us and clearly to the commission that there are many other sources that would be used for many, many, many years, 50, 100 years, instead of drilling a 15,000-foot, $10 million well.
So what Ulrich is saying is that water managers will have other sources to pick from before they would ever turn to this section of the Madison Aquifer. The commission agreed with Encana, and the Department of Environmental Quality, which initially expressed concerns about the exemption, withdrew them. But some questions remain. The state geologist, Tom Dreen, who sits on the commission, voted against the project.
It boiled down to me that in the modeling, they really took too simplistic of a geologic view, that they were treating the Madison formation as one ubiquitous or similar rock body throughout the whole 300-foot thickness, when in reality, we know from a geologic point of view, that's not accurate.
The Environmental Protection Agency is with Dreen. They sent a letter to the commission after they approved the project, saying Encana's model is very general and recommended that the model be modified to actually reflect the geology in the area. It matters because the aquifer slopes up from the injection well, getting shallower, and eventually it hits the surface. Encana says they'll affect a 4.5-mile area around the well. Dreen says that might not be accurate.
If their model is incorrect, and if they are affecting a bigger area, and if you look at the dips of the beds, rock formation as it comes out of the basin, if it begins to affect a significantly larger area than that, well, all of a sudden it comes up to shallower depths. And then as it comes up to shallower depths, well, all of a sudden you're getting closer and closer and closer what might be economically viable or a useful water resource for the public.
The other question is a bit broader. Should we be taking relatively fresh water sources off the table just because they're not viable now? The American Water Works Association is a nonprofit focused on improving water quality and supply. The association's Alan Roberson says Encana is probably right about this well not being practical as a fresh water source.
But I think it's a question where the science is evolving that we're not really sure how far out to go. It's a question where I'd say the science is evolving right now.
For one, Roberson says that perhaps 100 years, the time frame Encana's model uses, isn't actually that long when planning for water needs. But also, Roberson says already people are drilling deeper and transporting water for longer distances than they had previously done.
People are going further away. The easier sources, the closer sources have already been used.
And it should be noted that the number of aquifer exemption requests is growing along with the energy industry's activity. That includes oil, gas, and uranium. In 2011 and 2012, the EPA permitted 73 aquifer exemptions in Wyoming alone. Powder River Basin Resource Council's Jill Morrison says that's a troubling trend, especially if aquifers of relatively fresh water are going to be part of that development.
The concerns are more long-term for future water use and the fact that we're potentially eliminating an aquifer from future water use and setting up that precedent.
Wyoming currently relies on groundwater for nearly 40% of its water needs. Indeed, the very same Madison aquifer is used for drinking water in other parts of the state and country. Dreen, the geologist, says he's for energy development in the state and might have voted for the exemption had Encana's model been better. But he does say that predicting what will be viable in the future is hard.
The one thing I think we do know when it comes to water resources is that they've always been precious in states like Wyoming. And I think as time goes by, fresh water and drinking water is going to become more and more precious around the world.
Encana is still formulating its response to EPA's questions and cannot use their well until the EPA signs off on the project. The well would only be used to dispose of produced water from the 280 currently operating production wells. But the project is just beginning. Encana is proposing to drill over 4,000 wells in the Moneta Divide project. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhurov.
When we come back, we'll hear about DEQ's new engine emissions testing initiative, the sequel to Gasland, and why value-added coal projects keep failing in Wyoming. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. The Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality has been running an engine emissions study for almost 2 years now. For the most part, Wyoming oil and gas fields are not connected to the grid, and so they end up running on engines, which emit pollutants into the air. The study set out to evaluate emissions from these generators around the state. Results from the study show that a large percentage of the engines failed the tests. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhurov spoke with the DEQ air quality engineer in charge of the study, John Walker, about why that is.
The engine emissions study was started out of internal discussions about air quality permit requirements. Essentially, we just decided we didn't have any data to make decisions with, and that led to the project starting in May of 2011.
What's the operator's responsibility generally for testing these engines? Is their testing different from what the DEQ is doing?
It's, for all practical purposes, what we expect of them is identical to the level of monitoring that we're doing right now. It's all about maintenance. I mean, this type of testing is necessary for maintenance of the engine.
So can you kind of describe in a bit more detail what the value of the test is then?
We've learned a lot from this in terms of, you know, our monitoring results being indicative of noncompliance and in what form, you know, the noncompliance exists. We haven't been using it for enforcement. I would say the project's headed that direction.
According to the results that were released last fall, a vast majority of the engines tested by the DEQ failed the tests, which seems pretty bad. So can you kind of explain those results and if you've seen anything change in consequent testing?
I wouldn't say the vast majority. our test results basically have shown that there's operators that are doing a very good job with their maintenance and monitoring. Some operators are not, and that's a problem. You know, our results were not favorable. Obviously, we have things to work on, as well as the operators.
So have you seen anything change in consequent testing?
We have. If we were to, you know, kind of talk about things that aren't working out there, maybe 70% of the poorly performing operations simply aren't monitoring emissions. In other words, they aren't incorporating emissions monitoring with their maintenance. I think this project has had a big impact on that. There's people out there they're doing monitoring, and I think that, you know, every year we go back, we visit operations. We focus on the operations that haven't performed well previously. Generally speaking, we're seeing a large improvement. The other problem we kind of identify is, I think the people, that maybe 30% are doing the monitoring, but the corrective actions that they're doing when they identify a problem simply aren't effective. They're not necessarily identifying the root cause of problems, and so they make adjustments that aren't capable of keeping the engine in compliance long-term. So there's a real need there for emissions training.
I'm wondering why that training is missing when the engines are kind of already in operation.
The people that do this well, they have a very unique skill. There's a lot of component manufacturers that provide training on their specific part, whether it be the engine or a controller or a catalyst. To my knowledge, the people that do this well have learned it by their, you know, years in the field. You know, that's a difficult way to learn how to do something real well.
I guess my question is it unfair to demand more stringently that if an operator is running an engine, they should understand them and maintain them better and kind of come in with that experience, or is that impossible to do to some extent?
Well, obviously, we expect the engines to be operated in compliance. Absolutely. And you know, the things we're seeing, it is about air quality. It is about, you know, engines being maintained properly. It is about emissions, but it's also about a lot of money. You know, some of the things that are going on are really they're consuming a lot more fuel than they should be. They're damaging engines. You know, there's a lot of money involved here. So the reason that this, with those operations, why that poor maintenance exists, you know, I can't put my finger on that.
So in terms of what you're gaining from this study, is it more of how to monitor some of these operators and how to make sure that they're in compliance, or is it going to lead to any sort of rules changes for the regulations?
You know, as far as, you know, permitting changes and stuff like that, I'd have to refer you to the, you know, the permitting group in Cheyenne. But what we've seen is, from when we started doing this testing 2 years ago, we've learned a lot about, you know, this kind of testing, for example, and the value of it. And I think what we've seen is it's basically kind of evolved into more of a compliance function, and that's the direction we're still headed today.
Can you talk a little bit more about what you want to accomplish in the coming year?
We've raised the bar every year. Initially, we were just out collecting data. As of today, we're requiring follow-up testing based on our results, and possibly in the, you know, not too distant future, we'll be doing on-site reference method testing. So, you know, I think the program has evolved, and there is value in the field activity and focusing on the problems of specific operations versus, for example, a regulatory approach that affects the entire industry.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you so much, John.
Thank you, Irina.
Over the years, many researchers have looked at a variety of research and economic development projects using Wyoming coal. The idea is to open up new markets for it and to make it more viable for businesses and the public to use. Much of this has surrounded coal gasification. There's been a belief that coal could be used as a form of liquid fuel. That was especially useful when oil supplies appeared limited in the United States. But as the country entered a technology revolution and opened up more resources, the interest dropped. Experts say that the reason interest has waned is because these projects never work out.
You understand that I think coal to liquids is a schlock deal. It is. It'll never fly.
That's University of Wyoming Emeritus Professor E.G. Jerry Meyer. Meyer has done plenty of coal research over the years, but he says efforts like the DKRW coal-to-gas proposal for Carbon County will never get anywhere. DKRW is the most recent effort at turning coal into liquid fuel. Meyer says such projects are very capital-intensive to produce something that cheaper oil and natural gas can already be used for. He says when you then realize that you also need to deal with CO2 that's produced, it can get very expensive.
So when you add up the whole thing, you understand you need two plants, which represents a large capital investment. When you understand that the process is not efficient, you ask yourself, does this really make sense? And the answer is no.
Another longtime University of Wyoming professor who studied coal-to-liquids efforts is Harold Bergman. Bergman says Wyoming actually was heavily involved with coal-to-liquids efforts in the 70s, when the country was dealing with the oil embargo. But he says the plants at the time found out that there was a lot of liquid waste created from those efforts, which was problematic. And when the oil crisis ended, so did the interest in coal-to-gasoline. Various other coal experiments were floated through the years. In the 90s, as a member of the Wyoming Environmental Quality Council and later as head of the Ruckelshaus Institute on Environment and Natural Resources, Bergman saw a number of coal projects come and go.
These coal gasification, liquefaction, and oil shale retorting operations all collapsed because of cost.
Ben Avery of the Wyoming Business Council says most of the efforts to liquefy coal either came from researchers, non-coal companies, or the federal government. But when the research is finished, the projects come to an end.
I've yet to see a business plan on one of these coal to liquids facilities.
Avery says the same goes for other value-added coal projects.
We've got companies interested in doing that underground coal gasification, capturing the CO2, and doing that for enhanced oil recovery, using the CO2 for enhanced oil recovery. Seems to potentially be perhaps a little less capital-intensive cost than the coal to liquid.
Whether that amounts to anything remains to be seen, but the intentions are there. Professor Bergman says diversifying Wyoming's economy and finding new ways to try to save what's becoming a declining coal market is a reason for it, but still a bad idea. He says research dollars can be better spent elsewhere.
The DKRW or other coal to liquids or coal to gas operations seem to me to be environmentally and economically foolhardy to the extreme.
While some point out that South Africa has had success with such projects, Bergman notes that it came at a time when South Africa was cut off from the rest of the world and needed coal to liquids for fuel. And for those looking at ways to use U.S. coal differently in the current market, Bergman is skeptical.
Now there's so much cheap gas in the world because of the production of gas from fracking that even to make plastics or some other product out of coal, it's still going to be way, way cheaper to just use natural gas.
As mentioned earlier, UW Emeritus Professor Jerry Meyer does believe that some coal research makes sense, and he's in favor of efforts to break up the molecules in coal and use it for commerce. Meyer says if you want to do something new with coal, this is the best approach.
We will use coal as it should be used, as a raw material to produce chemicals and char. Char is another form of carbon. It can be used not only as a fuel, but it can be used as an adsorbent in such things as gas masks, in reducing pollutants.
One last point about all these coal research efforts. Very few of these ideas are coming from those directly involved in the coal industry. Meyer notes that coal companies do not have the research teams that oil companies employ. While researchers and others look at doing new things with coal, he says coal companies are, quote, dig it and ship it guys. Gasland is a documentary about the negative effects of natural gas drilling. The narrator in the movie is seeking answers about natural gas development in light of a growing play around his own home in the Delaware River Basin, and his inquiries take him on a road trip to communities around the U.S. that have already been drilled into and have something to say about it. When the movie came out, it made big waves, and Gasland 2 premieres this weekend. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhorov reports on what's changed since the first movie came out in 2010.
Josh Fox, the narrator and director of Gasland, went looking for people with oil and gas development in their backyards. In one scene in Colorado, he follows a man to what looks like his basement and records as the man tries to set the water in his faucet on fire.
Oh yeah, I saw it go out for a second.
Yeah.
The water suddenly lights.
Whoa, Jesus Christ.
Fireball hangs in the sink for a moment.
That's the best I've got.
And the camera pans to Fox's shocked expression.
I smell hair.
Oh, damn. Can I try it?
Yeah.
The film is full of such testimonies from communities across Pennsylvania, Colorado, Texas, and Wyoming. And when the movie came out, it inspired more than a little curiosity about this thing, this drilling, that was happening in towns across America.
He gave them this word, fracking, that people are able to identify this with, and it's become this term that is so easily identified now. People know what you're talking about when you say the word fracking.
That was John Fenton. He lives in Pavilion, Wyoming. Fox featured Fenton's story in the movie.
John Fenton and his wife Kathy have 24 gas wells on their property, all of them visible from their front porch.
Fenton says Gasland informed people about what fracking actually entails.
You see these fancy ads on TV with the attractive woman clomping through in her high heels and telling you how wonderful natural gas is and all these they're so safe, and the people on the ground were seeing the opposite of that.
Fenton says his water went bad after wells went up on his property. He and some of his neighbors have been sharing their stories with whomever would listen for years. One neighbor, Jeff Locker, who also appears in Gasland, says the film helped with their efforts.
I think it's had a huge impact. It's brought an awareness to fracking and the drilling processes and everything that goes on that we've never had before.
But director Josh Fox doesn't take all the credit for the drastic growth of citizen participation and involvement in discussions about fracking.
I think there was a movement of people springing up across the United States as a reaction to how invasive this industry was. And that the film came along right at the right time that sort of said, oh my God, this is happening in all these places at once. You know, I can't take the credit for that. I think it's like a Newtonian physics equation. You know, every action will have an equal and opposite reaction.
Fox had hoped that the movie would incite industry to engage with the public about their concerns. Instead, Fox said they responded with adamant denial. He compared it to the way the tobacco industry reacted to the early links between smoking and cancer.
The tobacco industry spent decades deliberately trying to obscure that information, come up with bogus science, buy off studies and so on, and we're seeing exactly the same thing happening from the oil and gas industry. I am not seeing a reform created by the industry.
Industry was not a big fan of the movie. What Fox sees as his truths, the Wyoming Petroleum Association's Bruce Hinchey says were non-factual, misleading, and not truthful. But if 50 million people have seen the movie, like Fox estimates, did industry have to somehow address the issues Gasland raised, even if it deemed them non-factual? Has it changed how industry kind of approaches conversations with citizens, with landowners? I guess I'm wondering if it changed how PR works for industry to any extent.
I don't think so. I don't. In fact, I would doubt very seriously if 50 million people saw the movie.
But industry did not quite stand by so passively. Several movies came out responding to Gasland and refuting its allegations of wrongdoing by the oil and gas industry. At least one of those responses was funded by industry dollars. The Independent Petroleum Association of America took the time to critique Fox's film, and when Gasland was nominated for an Oscar, they also cast their vote.
They like appealed to the Oscars to rescind the nomination. They practically handed us the Oscar. You know, we didn't win, but, you know, we had a chance at that point. You know? So, like, I think what they're doing is alerting a lot more people to the fact that they're behaving in this way.
Fox also says lobbying efforts by industry and the money spent on them skyrocketed. But Fenton says no matter. The movie still accomplished what matters most.
Through the history of this country, where people have been exploited, it's not the government that changes that. It's the people who are impacted that change that. The people who have been hurt, who have been damaged, are the ones who band together and who change harmful practices and harmful political stances. So I think that's been the biggest impact from this, is it's empowered people who, in the past, thought, I don't really have a voice. Nobody wants to listen to what I have to say. And me including.
Gasland 2 delves into the role of government and regulatory agencies in oil and gas development. It premieres this weekend at the Tribeca Film Festival in New York. The movie will tour around the U.S. and air on HBO this summer. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Jouroff.
When we come back, I'll speak with a historian and author, David McCullough. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Author and historian David McCullough is a two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize. He has also twice won the National Book Award and has been awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom for his books on American history. He spoke about history, education, and a number of topics this week at the University of Wyoming, and I was able to catch up with him following his talk. One of the things I've always wanted to ask you is what your take is on, you hear politicians frequently discuss, well, the forefathers wanted this and the forefathers think this. As somebody who actually knows a little bit about what the forefathers said and thought, what do you make of that? Does anybody get it?
Well, I take most of it with a pretty big grain of salt, because what the forefathers said or thought is a little like saying, using the Bible to back up some point of view you may have. There's a little something for everybody in there. The forefathers' thinking was all over the lot, and say, in matters of religion. There was every variety of devout Christians, agnostics, atheists. There is no one thought about that, except their general belief that a government, a country governed by the people or representatives of the people, was possible. It wasn't going to be easy, but it was possible. Many of the forefathers didn't think we would last very long. They weren't all optimistic by a long shot, but they sure would do everything in their power to make it happen in their lifetime.
And I was curious, did you sense that they always had a short-term look at things, or did most of them have a long view?
The real movers and shakers did have a long view. I can't speak for everybody else. There were an awful lot of them, remember. The big choice, of course, was whether it was to be truly a federal government, whether the federal government was going to be the ultimate power or the states. And we've struck a pretty good balance ever since. The supremacy of the federal government has been in itself, a major attainment, a major achievement. It is not often seen as such, but should be.
I want to ask you about the people that you've written about. When you learn more about a Harry Truman or whoever it is, a John Adams, how do you put yourself into their situation, and how exciting is it to maybe live in that time with them?
I've never failed to be in awe or more impressed as my understanding expands with what all that role entails. President of the United States. It's a job beyond the capacity of any one human being, no question about that. What I admire most is the capacity for some men, and of course it's only been men so far, to see what has to be done and not let the 101 issues, crises, small brush fires and the rest, they break out all the time, but to keep going and what it is you really want to accomplish.
One of the things I got from your talk at the University of Wyoming this week was how excited, the better word is how amazed you are at how this country has overcome some things and how some people have survived some things. You make that point a lot. And would you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I don't think we can ever give sufficient credit and respect, admiration, for those that we are descended from and what they went through to achieve what they did. We take these things for granted.
Sure.
We take the creation of this university, Wyoming University. But it didn't just fall out of the sky. Somebody had to do it all, had to make it all, had to have the idealism and the long-range imagination to foresee when there would be a great university here. The obvious ones, like going to the moon or inventing so much that we have. If there's a clue, a key to why we are the way we are, why we have succeeded in so many ways, far beyond any other people in history, far beyond any other people in the world, is because of education available to everybody, in theory and often in practice. And no civilization has ever offered that. We do. And we've created the greatest universities in the world. No small accomplishment, to say the least. And it's as if we don't see that. We have been cathedral builders, but we don't see the cathedrals we built. And yes, those universities can be improved. Yes, they have failed in some respects. Yes, they're very expensive, in some cases outrageously expensive. But nonetheless, look what we have done, and let's keep it going. Let's make it even better.
David McCullough, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Tara Orr is our web editor. You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site and sign up for our podcast. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.